Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Welcome to The Deep Dive. Today, we are immersing ourselves in the really extraordinary and, let's be honest, often excruciatingly awkward world of Sacha Baron Cohen.
Mm-hmm.
This is a figure who's built an entire, like, multi-decade career out of creating chaos, using, you know, highly sophisticated deception to force people to confront and often proudly display their most uncomfortable truths.
That's absolutely right. Cohen is, well, he's far more than just a comedian in a funny costume, isn't he?
Yeah.
He is essentially a kind of satirical surgeon.
Yeah.
He uses his fictional alter egos, you know, Ali G, Borat Sagdiev, Bruno Gayhard, and Admiral General Hafiz Al-Adin as these incredibly precise instruments.
Right.
His entire methodology, it seems, designed to expose genuine societal flaws, bigotry, prejudice, making subjects reveal what they really believe when they think they're in a safe space, or maybe just dealing with someone ignorant.
And our mission today, looking at this, well, pretty dense stack of sources we've got, is to really look past the punchlines, past the ridiculous accents. We're analyzing his whole arc, from his academic background through his meticulous, it's almost spy level, isn't it? Preparation, his methods of deception.
Oh, absolutely.
The massive legal battles that follow him everywhere. And then that eventual shift into, well, serious acting and public activism. We're tracking a career that spans, what, from 1995 right up to now.
And you're tracking a really critically acclaimed provocateur. I mean, the quick facts alone tell a story of high achievement alongside, well, considerable risk.
Mm-hmm.
Born Sacha Noam Baron Cohen, 1971, London. He hasn't just achieved fame. He's got institutional recognition for basically elaborate trickery.
It's kind of amazing when you put it like that.
It is. 2 BAFTA TV awards, 3 Golden Globes, major nominations across comedy and drama, 3 Academy Awards nods, 6 Primetime Emmy nominations. It's a remarkable tally for someone whose main job is essentially high-stakes political performance art.
Okay, so let's unpack where this intensity, this rigor comes from. Because when you look at the characters, whether it's Ali G, the suburban chav, or Borat, the supposedly anti-Semitic Kazakh journalist, you realize this isn't just accidental comedy.
No, not at all.
All his foundation is, like you said, intensely academic. And it seems deeply informed by a really profound personal history.
This is where the intellectual engine really starts, I think. He comes from a strong, established English family, specifically an Ashkenazi Jewish family.
Right.
And for listeners who might not know, Ashkenazi refers to Jews whose ancestors came from Central and Eastern Europe. Often there's a strong cultural lineage there tied to historical displacement. His father was an editor, owned a clothing store, and had roots in Belarus.
And his mother's side, that really emphasizes the kind of historical weight he seems to carry, doesn't it?
It really does. She was a photographer born in British Mandatory Palestine back in 1939. Her parents were German Jewish, and crucially, they had fled the Nazis in 1936. So this heritage, this direct, you know, intergenerational experience of fleeing persecution, witnessing the absolute darkest parts of European history, it feels absolutely critical to understanding the sort of moral mission that seems to drive his later, most confrontational work, especially Borat.
That serious intellectual foundation, it's mirrored in his education too, right?
Absolutely. He went to the independent Catholic school, St. Columbus College, then finished secondary at Haberdasher's Assas Boys School, and then came Cambridge, Creese College, studied history, graduated in 93 with upper second class honors.
And his academic focus wasn't just, you know, broad history. It was laser-focused and almost predictive of his career. Looking back, his thesis was on the role of Jewish activists in the American Civil Rights Movement, a really complex, often controversial topic.
That specific research area is so telling, isn't it?
Yeah.
To deep dive into how a minority group integrates, how they navigate conflict, opposition. Specifically, how they use leverage and activism, often through unconventional means, to fight for justice in a really polarized society.
So that analytical framework, using marginalized or othered identities to confront established power structures.
That's the blueprint. It's the intellectual blueprint for every single character he's ever created. He was analyzing social leverage long before he ever put on, you know, the fluorescent tracksuit or the gray mustache.
And he wasn't just reading history. He was performing, too, even back then.
Right. At Cambridge, he was in the Amateur Dramatic Club.
Yeah.
Did classics like Fiddler on the Roof, Cyrano de Bergerac.
Mm-hmm.
Also acted with Habonim Dror, the labor youth movement.
Habonim Dror. That's important context, isn't it? A socialist Zionist youth movement.
Exactly. It shows an early active connection to organized political and ideological communities. And after university, he deepened that commitment. Spent a year volunteering on kibbutzim in Israel, those collective settlements, Rosh Hanukkah and Beit Hamik specifically.
So he wasn't just your typical British university comedian. He was actively engaging in these quite complex geopolitical and cultural spaces early on. But when he talks about his comedic DNA, his influences, it's interesting. He doesn't really point to the classic British satirical establishment like Monty Python, although he was a fan.
No, he singles out one figure above all.
Peter Sellers.
Peter Sellers. Yeah, this is like the Rosetta Stone for understanding his performance method. Sellers, you know, famous for Clouseau, Dr. Strangelove.
Incredible commitment to character, accents.
Precisely. And Cohen explicitly admired Sellers' ability to be, quote, incredibly realistic actor who was also hilarious and who managed to bridge the gap between comedy and satire.
That bridge. Comedy and satire, that feels like the key distinction for Cohen.
It is. He called Sellers the most seminal force in shaping his early ideas on comedy. It wasn't just after laughs. He wanted to use realistic performance to trick the audience and, crucially, his interviewees into suspending disbelief just long enough for the satire to hit home.
And that realism, that wasn't just instinct, right? He actually trained for it.
He did, formally. After Cambridge, he went to Paris, studied at the legendary École Philippe Goliot, to clown training.
Clown training. Now, most people hear that and think, you know, red noses, big shoes.
Right. But the Goliot method is much deeper.
Yeah.
It's about theatrical presence, impulse, and really importantly, mask work. Finding the truth within an absurd character.
And Goliot himself apparently thought he was pretty good.
Yeah, described him as a good clown, full of spirit. And Cohen credits that training completely. He said, without him, I really do doubt whether I would have had any success in my field.
Wow, okay.
So that foundation, formal performance, mask work, that explains why his characters aren't just impressions. They're fully constructed, psychologically consistent beings that effectively hide the man's actual intent.
Mm.
And that enables the deception that really defines his whole career.
That rigorous commitment,
yeah,
rooted in history and clown training, that's what let him weaponize surprise so effectively. Let's start with the character that really launched him globally, Ollie G.
Right, Ollie G, Alistair Graham.
He was this embodiment of a cultural collision, wasn't he? A fictional stereotype, white British suburban guy, the Chav, wholeheartedly mimicking urban black British hip-hop, Jamaican culture, speaking in that exaggerated rude boy style, and claiming to be from Staines, of all places.
Staines, massive.
Yeah.
A deeply conservative suburban town. The character debuted in these little two-minute sketches on the 11 o'clock show back in 98.
And blew up fast.
Instantly. Led to Die, Ollie G show in 2000, won a BAFTA.
Uh-huh.
Became a cultural icon. He was the limo driver in Madonna's music video that same year.
The initial satire, especially in Britain, was really targeting cultural appropriation, right? And that hilarious disconnect between the suburban reality and the adopted street persona.
Exactly. But the real insight for us, the thing that defines Cohen's whole modus operandi, is that methodology of deception. The incredibly elaborate ritual he and his team figured out to consistently fool respected, usually cautious people, senior politicians, business leaders, celebs, into doing these ridiculous, often reputation-destroying interviews.
This is the really fascinating part, almost like spycraft.
It is. It's forensic. Sources like Rolling Stone documented this multi-layered trick. It relied on misdirection, exploiting the subject's professional expectations. Sacha Baron Cohen, dressed as Ali G, would enter the interview space first.
But he wouldn't act like the star.
No, he'd act like an inconspicuous crew member, maybe carrying gear, fiddling with the camera, something like that.
And the real deception was aimed at the subject's handlers, wasn't it?
Absolutely. The interviewee was led to believe that a different person, some serious-looking, well-dressed guy in a suit who came with the crew, that guy was going to conduct the actual serious interview for broadcast.
Okay.
So then Baron Cohen, still dressed as Ali G, sits down with the interviewee and asks a few preliminary questions.
So the subjects are completely off guard. They think it's just a sound check, camera test.
Or maybe just a quick disposable chat before the real interview screens. Yeah. They're relaxed, maybe a bit amused by this silly guy, but they haven't put up their political or media defenses yet.
And then the trap springs?
Right before the cameras officially roll, they reveal the suited man is just the director or producer, and Ali G is the actual main interviewer. At that point, the subject's invested time, they've probably signed releases, there's a live camera crew. They're psychologically cornered.
It's masterful manipulation, as you said, making it incredibly hard, maybe impossible, for them to back out right then without admitting they'd been totally fooled in canceling this whole big production.
Exactly. Cohen ensured the interview went ahead, often with incredibly damaging results for the subject. And the same sophisticated method, he perfected it and then applied it to his most famous and arguably most explosive character, Borat Sagdiyev.
Borat, the Kazakh journalist. He evolved from an earlier character, Alexei Krikler, back in 96.
Right.
But became a global phenomenon with the 2006 film Borat, Cultural Learnings of America for Make Benefit, Glorious Nation of Kazakhstan.
Borat's comedic strategy is just pure, unadulterated confrontation, built on that outsider persona. His humor relies on mocking societal norms by presenting these utterly outrageous, often repulsive viewpoints, violating taboos, using gross vulgarity.
And the 2006 film, the mockumentary format, it explicitly used interviews with various Americans to poke fun at the culture, but also to expose really deep-seated flaws.
Yeah.
Sexism, racism, homophobia, anti-Semitism, jingoism.
All of it. Yeah.
Which brings us right to the core ethical, intellectual dilemma of his career, really. That intense controversy around Borat's own fictional blatant anti-Semitism, which Cohen used not as a character flaw, but as a deliberate strategic tool.
This is the moment we really need to spend some time on because it connects directly back to his Cambridge thesis, his family history, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
His defense of using Borat's anti-Semitism was explicit, deeply intentional. Baron Cohen argues that by adopting this character, Borat acts as a tool to let unsuspecting bigots lower their guard and expose their own prejudice. The character is basically bait.
But it went deeper than just exposing outright bigotry, didn't it? He talked about indifference.
Exactly. That was the more profound philosophical argument. He directly connected his method to the historian Ian Kershaw, quoting his assessment that the path to Auschwitz was paved with indifference.
Wow.
And if you look at that performance, the infamous song, "In My Country There Is Problem" or "Throw the Jew Down the Well" in the 2006 film, this principle is just laid bare.
Yeah, that scene is unforgettable.
Borat, performing in front of this small working-class bar audience, singing overtly anti-Semitic lyrics, asking the audience to sing along, celebrate the violence.
And the crowd.
Yeah.
They don't recoil. They cheer. They sing along.
Yeah.
Enthusiastically.
It's really jarring to think about that level of premeditated intellectual manipulation just to get that reaction right. He suggested that the audience members cheering didn't necessarily see themselves as raging anti-Semites.
Their indifference.
Their indifference. Their willingness to participate in this violent genocidal fantasy just because they thought it was funny or harmless, that was the real target. The character exposed indifference to prejudice just as much as, maybe even more than, actual bigotry.
That's the high wire act of his satire, isn't it? It's like,
yeah,
investigative theater with this explicit moral historical core.
Totally. But the character was so effective, so globally exposed, that the element of surprise started to vanish. He actually had to announce Borat's retirement in 2007, said the public had become too familiar, making that necessary deception impossible.
But retirement's never permanent in comedy, is it?
Apparently not.
He won the Golden Globe for Best Actor in 2007 for the first film, got an Oscar nomination for Best Adapted Screenplay.
Huge recognition.
And then he successfully resurrected Borat for the 2020 sequel, Borat Subsequent Movie Film, proving that even familiarity can be overcome, especially in our current age of, you know, increased political polarization.
Mm-hmm. He even appeared as Borat at the 2022 Kennedy Center Honors, which shows just how much the character, despite the controversy, became institutionally accepted in a way.
In between those Borat outings, though, there was Bruno. Bruno Gayhart.
Ah, yes, Bruno. The flamboyantly gay Austrian fashion show presenter.
Bruno's satirical targets felt a bit different, didn't they? More focused on the fashion world, the clubbing scene.
Yeah, the vacuity, the utter inanity, and often the hidden homophobia within those worlds.
Bruno was defined by those specific catchphrases. Masu, I don't think so. Ah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This character also pushed boundaries of taste, maybe even more extremely than Borat sometimes, like that interview prompt where he tried to get a guest to choose between keep them in the ghetto or train to Auschwitz, just trying to force that reaction of moral outrage.
It's interesting, though, while his whole career is built on unscripted chaos, Bruno was responsible for one of his most famous and actually confirmed staged stunts.
The Eminem incident.
The aerial drop onto Eminem at the 2009 MTV Movie Awards, descending from the ceiling, landing buttocks first onto the rapper's face,
became instant viral legend, and Eminem later admitted it was all pre-planned with Cohen and the team.
Right, which shows this secondary layer to his work sometimes. The chaos can be meticulously controlled, pre-negotiated, just for maximum promotional impact, even while the core of the film still relies on duping unknowing people. And the stakes were huge financially, too. Universal reportedly paid $42.5 million for the Bruno film rights after a bidding war.
Wow. Okay, so after the height of that mockumentary era, Cohen made a really clear structural shift in 2012 with The Dictator, playing Admiral General Aladeen.
Yes, this was a pivotal moment. He moved completely away from the hidden camera, unwitting interviewee format. This is a conventional, fully scripted narrative feature film.
The satire was still there, though, still totally political. The film was marketed as, what was it, the heroic story of a dictator who risked his life to ensure that democracy would never come to the country he so lovingly embraced.
Brilliant tagline. And the main satirical target, when they were writing it, was the then still alive Libyan dictator, Muammar Gaddafi.
And the producers were actually worried about real-world threats.
They were. So concerned about angering Gaddafi, maybe provoking retaliation, even a terrorist attack, that they deliberately put out misinformation.
What did they say?
They claimed the film was loosely based on some fictional romance novel written by Saddam Hussein.
That's wild. They felt they had to distract actual dictators with fake source material just to keep the production safe.
It really speaks volumes about the perceived global threat level of his satire, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And true to form, the promotion was pure Cohen chaos. He showed up on the Oscars red carpet.
With the urn.
With the urn. Flanked by uniformed female bodyguards holding an urn he claimed contained Kim Jong-il's ashes, which he then accidentally spilled, later admitting it was just flour all over Ryan Seacrest.
Poor Ryan Seacrest.
That incident just perfectly encapsulated his brand. High production value, maximum political commentary, and utter theatrical chaos.
Then, in 2018, he came roaring back to the deep deception format with the Showtime series Who is America?
Yeah, the pressure was immense then, because he'd already basically said the format was impossible due to his fame. He had to create a whole new set of highly specialized, completely unrecognizable characters.
And the standout was Aaron Morad.
Aaron Morad, yeah. The aggressive, macho, Israeli anti-terrorism expert. His identity kept shifting. Colonel, Captain, General, Major. And he always had that caveat, former agent, or specifically, not in the Mossad.
Right.
This character was incredibly effective, generated conservative outrage before the show even aired, with public figures rushing out press releases saying they'd been tricked.
The most famous segment, the most politically impactful, has to be Kindergartens.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Morad successfully convinced senior conservative figures, including sitting members of Congress like Joe Wilson and Dana Rohrabacher, former Congressman Joe Walsh, to openly support this truly disturbing proposal.
A fictional, totally absurd program to arm children, age 3 to 16, with guns to protect themselves in schools.
The absurdity was the key. Morad presented these politicians with literature, cartoon illustrations of toddlers holding assault rifles, completely straight-faced, arguing that toddlers have the same biological instincts to aim a gun as adults.
And these politicians, thinking they were supporting some cutting-edge Israeli anti-terrorism tech,
went on camera. Read teleprompter statements endorsing the concept. Only Congressman Matt Gaetz apparently expressed immediate skepticism and refused to do the video part.
But the segments were incredibly potent. especially the one that effectively ended the political career of Jason Spencer, a Republican state representative from Georgia.
This is a perfect example of Cohen's work having immediate, real-world political consequences, way beyond just entertainment. Morehead convinced Spencer he needed to practice these secret counterterrorism techniques to distract potential terrorists.
Techniques that required Spencer to overcome his fear by going to ludicrous extremes.
Ludicrous is putting it mildly. Spencer performed several racially charged and deeply humiliating acts on camera, taking pictures of a woman's burqa with a selfie stick.
Oh my.
Walking backward, bearing his buttocks, yelling America Great in a mock Asian accent, and shouting racial slurs, specifically the N-word, during a fake training drill to attract attention.
The fallout was immediate, wasn't it?
Totally. The episode aired July 29, 2018. Spencer initially refused to step down, claimed he'd been exploited. But the footage was just so politically devastating, so career-ending. He officially resigned July 31st, before his term was even up.
That really proved that even years later, his hidden camera stuff, when it worked, could still wield devastating social and political power.
Definitely. But just like with Borat, the success of Who is America proved to be its immediate undoing. It confirmed Cohen's earlier statement. He declared definitively that a second season was impossible. The intense publicity from season one just made it too difficult to dupe high-profile guests again. The sheer effectiveness of the method basically consumes its own ability to continue on that scale.
What's equally remarkable, though, is that running parallel to this career of just chaotic, often career-ending stunts, Cohen has always maintained this completely separate track as a versatile, serious, dramatic actor.
Mm-hmm. The transition is seamless. It really speaks volumes about his command over performance itself.
His range is genuinely surprising when you list it out. We know him as King Julian XIII, the lemur in Madagascar.
Right, the voice work.
And then there's that hysterical performance as Jean Giraud, the French Formula One driver in Talladega Nights. But he quickly started taking on serious period roles that required him to completely ditch the outlandishness.
He transitioned beautifully. Played the highly dramatic role of Signor Adolfo Pirelli, the rival barber, in Tim Burton's Sweeney Todd.
Right.
Appeared as Inspector Gustave Daste in Scorsese's Hugo. And maybe most memorably, played the despicable innkeeper Thénardier in the 2012 film of Les Misérables.
And in all those roles, you just don't see Borat or Ali G. You see a skilled character actor. Which brings us back to that Peter Sellers Foundation, right? The ability to just disappear into a realistic character, regardless of the genre.
Exactly. And that skill set eventually brought him the highest critical recognition for his straight acting. Nominations for playing significant dramatic historical figures.
Specifically, Abbie Hoffman. His portrayal of the political activist and anarchist in the trial of the Chicago 7 back in 2020.
That performance earned him the Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actor. His first Oscar nod for acting, adding to the screenwriting nomination for Borat.
And that dramatic focus seems to be continuing. He played the real-life Israeli spy Eli Cohen in the limited series The Spy in 2019, anchored a serious, tense drama.
Mm-hmm. Recently played Robert Ravenscroft in the Apple TV Plus miniseries Disclaimer in 2024. And moving into the big franchise world, he's slated to play the demonic villain Mephisto in the Disney Plus Ironheart series in 2025.
This successful transition, it isn't just about showing off versatility, is it? It feels like it mirrors his increasingly public and focused role as an activist and philanthropist. Stepping out from behind the masks to speak as himself, maybe the loss of the satirical tool pushed him towards more direct advocacy.
That seems plausible. He has become a highly vocal, very specific critic of modern information platforms, directly accusing social media companies of basically prioritizing profit over truth.
He's fierce about it. In that powerful 2019 speech, he singled out Facebook, Google, YouTube, Twitter, called them part of the biggest propaganda machine in history.
Pulled no punches. Claimed their lax rules on content moderation and hate speech meant that, quote, they would have let Hitler buy ads.
That kind of forthright, uncompromising stance, echoing his family history, his academic studies, that earned him the Anti-Defamation League's International Leadership Award in 2019, specifically for opposing bigotry and prejudice.
Right. And he's also a founding member of the Stop Hate for Profit movement, targeting companies that advertise on platforms failing to police hate speech.
And beyond the critical voice, his philanthropy is enormous and seems strategically focused on international aid. Our sources highlight that big donation in 2015. He and his then-wife, Isla Fisher, gave £335,000, half a million U.S. dollars, to save the children.
Yeah, for measles vaccinations for kids in northern Syria.
And they matched it, giving another half million to the International Rescue Committee for Syrian refugees. Aid, healthcare, sanitation.
This isn't just casual charity. It's large-scale, targeted intervention in global crises, entirely consistent with the moral foundation you see in his character work.
And that commitment's ongoing. As recently as October 2024, another huge donation, $500,000, split between Save the Children and IRC for relief efforts in the Sudan crisis. Famine, displacement.
And his political advocacy remains clear, current. 2023, he signed that open letter to President Biden calling for the release of hostages taken by Hamas. Later that year, challenged TikTok executives over content moderation, safety for Jewish users amidst the Gaza war.
So he uses his unmasked identity and influence to advocate for the exact kinds of victims and marginalized groups his satirical characters were often designed to protect or expose prejudice towards.
It's a clear through line.
Okay, so given that his entire comedy technique relies on, well, fraud and deliberate misrepresentation to get information, it's no surprise that the constant theme throughout his career is litigation, high-stakes lawsuits. How did his team keep him from getting bankrupted or just shut down?
Yeah, the price of satire is definitely high. Mm. But his legal defense seems built on two key pillars. First, he generally wins because subjects routinely sign these ironclad consent agreements and release forms beforehand.
Ah, the paperwork.
The paperwork. His legal team leverages those heavily, arguing the subject knowingly participated in a satirical context. Second, they frequently rely on anti-SLAPP statutes.
Okay, let's pause there. What exactly is anti-SLAPP for listeners who might not know?
Right. SLAPP stands for Strategic Lawsuits Against Public Participation. Basically, lawsuits filed not necessarily to win, but to intimidate, silence, or bankrupt critics by dragging them into expensive, long legal battles.
Oh, okay.
Anti-SLAPP laws are designed to protect free speech, journalism, satire, from these kinds of frivolous, retaliatory lawsuits. Since Cohen is clearly engaging in political satire, these laws often give his lawyers a powerful defense, letting them get cases dismissed early.
Good example. That huge lawsuit from Roy Moore, former Senate candidate in Alabama, yeah. $95 million over that mock interview in Who is America?
Right. Moore claimed defamation, emotional distress, argued he was tricked.
But that lawsuit was defeated.
Definitively. In 2022, the U.S. District Court found Moore had signed a consent agreement that explicitly barred his claims. The court confirmed he signed away his right to sue over stuff arising from the interview. Similar thing happened with those University of South Carolina students from Borat. They sued, claimed they were duped while drunk. Lawsuit dismissed in 2007 because the court said the contracts were valid.
But the danger wasn't always just legal, was it? Sources point out sometimes the consequences were very physical.
Oh, absolutely. The deception often put him in genuine physical danger.
Yeah.
During the Bruno filming in Jerusalem, he dressed in that camp version of traditional Hasidic clothing.
Yeah.
Deeply offended the local community. He was quickly chased by an angry mob throwing rocks, wanting to attack him. Mm. He only escaped by hiding in a shop. Later said the mob wanted to really kill me. It shows the extreme danger involved in his methods.
And there was one crucial legal failure, though, a case that resulted in a settlement.
Yes, the claim filed by Ayman Abu Ida, a Palestinian Christian grocer. This case is a critical nuance. Abu Ida was falsely identified in Bruno as a member of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades.
Okay.
Crucially, Abu Ida was a nonviolent activist, and unlike most of Cohen's subjects, he testified he never signed a release form or consent agreement.
Ah, no paperwork.
Exactly. Because that crucial legal paperwork was missing, his defamation claim was settled out of court in 2012 for an undisclosed amount. It really underscores that without that signed release, Cohen's whole legal strategy kind of collapses.
It's remarkable that for someone who is so public, so outrageous in character, the actual man, Sacha Baron Cohen himself, has always been fiercely private, especially early on.
That privacy was deliberate image management, it seems. He consciously avoided out-of-character interviews for much of the early 2000s. Director Larry Charles, who worked with him a lot, said it was to protect his weakness, maintain the integrity of the deception. The public needed to focus only on the character. Never the man pulling the strings.
Rolling Stone even called a 2006 piece, maybe hyperbolically, his only interview as himself.
Right. Despite that privacy, though, he's been clear about his personal life and his deep beliefs, confirmed he's immensely proud of his Jewish identity, stated he tries to keep kosher, attend synagogue maybe twice a year, fluent in Hebrew, again, showing how deep that intellectual, spiritual, cultural foundation runs through everything.
And his personal life. He met Australian actress Isla Fisher in Sydney back in 2001.
Mm-hmm. Long relationship. She converted to Judaism. They married in a Jewish ceremony in 2010. They have 3 children, 2 daughters, 1 son. They'd split time between London and L.A. before settling in Sydney for a while.
And they jointly announced filing for divorce late 2023, finalized June 2025. But they emphasized publicly they remain committed to co-parenting, remain friends despite the separation.
So, yeah, we circle back to that dual legacy we started with, really. Sacha Baron Cohen, this highly educated actor, screenwriter, major philanthropist, who successfully leveraged these controversial, high-risk comedic characters as a unique, powerful form of critical, confrontational social observation, all backed by this deep, serious moral intent.
His legacy isn't just the huge financial success or the critical acclaim, is it? It's the moral and political impact he managed to wield through deception. He forced people, powerful people, regular citizens to reveal their true selves, functioning like a highly accurate, very public human litmus test for bigotry, ignorance, prejudice.
He's a master of creating situations where apathy just isn't an option. He generated these uncomfortable truths, undeniable video evidence, stuff that sticks with you long after the initial shock or laugh fades away.
But here's the final compelling question we're left with, isn't it? Given that his methods are now compromised, he said it himself, the hidden camera high deception format is basically impossible now because the public media figures, they're just too familiar with his face, his methods.
Right. Which leaves him focusing almost entirely on conventional dramatic roles, roles he's highly celebrated for, and direct, non-character-based public advocacy.
So what does the effective end of his unique, unpredictable, hidden camera satire actually mean for political and social comedy? Are we losing a crucial, really uncomfortable mirror that forced society to see and confront its own prejudices? Simply because the targets learn how to recognize the man behind the mustache and maybe, crucially, learned how to look away.